Water is the lifeblood of the West and the stuff of legend in Southern California.
Gonna be a lot of irate citizens when they find out that they're paying for water that they're not gonna get.
Oh, that's all taken care of. See, Mr. Gibbs, either you bring the water to L.A. or you bring L.A. to the water.
Why are you doing it? How much better can you eat? What can you buy that you can't already afford?
The future, Mr. Gitz. The future.
This idea of taxpayers paying for water they never see is not Jack Nicholson fiction, and the Chinatown movie mythology of water riches buying the future is unraveling today in the middle of a real drought emergency. The Colorado River Basin is supposed to deliver water to 70% of residents in seven western states, including California and Arizona. But taxpayers stand in line for water behind farmers and big landowners, according to a deal made in the 1920s when the first big dams and water projects in the West were built. The deal hasn't changed. A new investigation from ProPublica does the math and challenges the continued subsidies for farmers in Arizona and California. Abram Lustgarten is an environmental reporter for ProPublica. He says no farmer in their right mind would be growing cotton in the middle of a drought, but for the billions of dollars in subsidies available from the U.S. Treasury.
Well, in Arizona in particular, they get their water from the Colorado River through a giant canal called the Central Arizona Project. They built this canal. It was completed in the 1990s, and it created a capacity for a huge amount of water, and the state got accustomed to using that much water. And as the Colorado River faces a shortage, there's likely to be a shortage declaration across the river next year, Arizona's share will be severely curtailed. So that canal will no longer function the way it was intended to, and the water supply that the state is used to getting and now depends on will be severely cut back.
Now, for most of American history, when conditions like this happened, it was the farmers who felt the pinch early and who either went out of business or just, really lived the pain of that natural disaster. But in this particular case, it's the farmers who really, they may see what's going on, but they aren't feeling it.
Yeah, the Colorado River, flips that dynamic on its head. When a farmer depends on natural rainfall to grow crops, then yes, they're the first ones to feel the effect of drought or climate change. But what happens in the Colorado River is the water is controlled and is distributed through these mechanisms. And the rights to that water are apportioned basically to the first to show up and claim it. So this happened in the late 1800s, early 1900s. The farmers were the first to settle that region, and they have what's called senior water rights. And so that means that through this plumbing distribution system, the farmers are essentially guaranteed to get their water before anybody else goes without. And because it's not raining right where the farmers are farming their crop, they're not dependent directly on that rainfall. Water rights are an important part of the value of property. They're an important part of what Western landowners see as their possession. And any effort to or even discussion of changing that is essentially, to them, amounts to a taking of their personal property.
But they didn't buy the water, right?
They didn't buy the water.
And they didn't build the equipment and the infrastructure that gives them the water, right?
Right. The Western water system is one of the most subsidized systems in the world, certainly in the country. The argument that the farmers will make is that they were incentivized to move out west by the government. They took a huge chance, put their family and livelihoods on the line, and went out and homesteaded new properties, took their 160-acre lots and took the water that they could get in order to build what we now appreciate as a robust and dynamic part of our economy in the Western states.
But how is that argument different from the argument that is pilloried in Washington when someone who gets a federal subsidy like food stamps says, it's my right, I don't have a job, I need these benefits, so you can't take them away from me, they're mine. It's essentially the same argument over entitlement to a kind of welfare, right?
Yeah, there are definitely people who make that argument out west. It is a touchy political conversation to have. I think what it boils down to is that the sort of subsidies and the sort of reliance on resources that we're talking about has been in place for a very, very long time. It's never really been questioned until now. The water scarcity situation has never quite been as severe as it is now. And essentially, habit has things pretty well entrenched.
What did you discover about the farmers themselves? How do they talk about this? How do they talk about their crops and their future and their plans?
Well, I spent a lot of time with cotton farmers in Arizona in particular, and the people I spent time with were incredibly cognizant and concerned about the water situation. They also feel a very strong sense of purpose. They're growing food, not in the case of cotton, obviously, but other crops, food that the world, that the country depends on. A huge portion of fruits and vegetables and nuts for the entire United States is grown in southern Arizona and southern California, dependent on Colorado River water. So they have a lot of mixed and conflicted feelings, well aware that they should be trying to use less water, well aware that their water resources are threatened, quite concerned about the way that the cities in the West are growing and their expectations to take water, and generally feeling that their use is superior in many ways to what urban water uses might demand.
And what about the choice of cotton as a crop?
Well, cotton in Arizona, where I looked, is you know, has been a staple crop of that state for much of the century, and it's incredibly water demanding. And there is not a really strong market for cotton, at least right now. The price is fairly low. There's a glut of it on the world market. There's not a lot of demand. And so what we found is that cotton is still being grown in Arizona, largely because of federal supports for the cotton crop, federal subsidies that come in a variety of shapes and sizes, but have in effect over many years, over the last 20 years, served to reduce the risk that a farmer makes, the business risk that a farmer makes in choosing to plant cotton, and essentially guaranteed them at least a break even, if not a little bit of profit. And so the net effect has been that while farmers may have switched away from cotton, partially in order to save water, they haven't done so, or they've done so more slowly because of the existence of the federal subsidies. Cotton is on the decline. It's steeply down from where it was a couple of decades ago. But the subsidies we found are one of the things that have gotten Arizona into the water mess that it's in and have really prolonged that transition.
Do you think this is a man-made drought?
I think that there's plenty of water in the West, and that's what a lot of the smartest sources that I talked to told me. So not to diminish what's happening in terms of drought. I mean, California environmentally is really suffering. But when you look at the amount of water that is still available to be used and the decisions that are being made about using it, it seems like there's some very, very straightforward and accessible opportunities to use it differently in ways that would free up a whole lot of water and ease the kind of pressures that the country is facing right now.
Abram Lustgarten is an environmental reporter for ProPublica. Abram, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 15,000 skills, like physics, photography, and parkour. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.